The United Nations started with 51 nations which were entitled to the privilege of original membership, which meant that they were considered members of the organization merely on the ratification of the charter. There was a provision for admission of other countries when they expressed their desire to come in. 8 countries have been admitted. 14 other countries have applied for membership, and their applications are still pending. In this connection, a very sharp controversy has arisen, or difference of view, between the Soviet Union and the other principal members of the organization. The Soviet Union has set up a theory that the admission of new members is something that can be bargained about, that it has a right to object to the admission of countries sponsored by the other countries if the other countries object to the admission of countries sponsored by itself. I think there are 5 countries, 5 applicants sponsored by the Soviet Union, and 9 sponsored by us and the other Western nations. These other, the principal other members of the United Nations, other than the Soviet Union, contend that each application should be considered on its own merit. The controversy has been referred to the International Court, which rendered an opinion adverse to the Soviet contention. Nevertheless, the Soviet government insists on its position. The problem is pending, and in fact, most of the Soviet vetoes that have attracted so much attention have been cast in connection with the admission of new members. One of the very important features of the organization that was not settled at the time that the charter was negotiated was the provision for the organization of national armed forces to be used jointly by it for the purposes of carrying out its duty. Again, a difficulty between the Soviet Union and the others, and the Military Staff Committee operating under the Security Council has so far been unable to find a solution. Still another problem of internal organization was connected with the fact that while the Charter charges the General Assembly with important responsibilities in the field of Pacific settlement and the maintenance of disputes and the maintenance of peace and security, no provision was made for any machinery with which the organization was to carry out these responsibilities. That was done deliberately because it was thought that experience would point the way for the General Assembly itself to set up such machinery, and the organization was given ample, the assembly was given ample authority to set up all the necessary machinery. Well, some years ago, an attempt was made to set up a piece of machinery of that sort, which became known as the Little Assembly. The Soviet Union objected to this. Nevertheless, in spite of its objection, the little assembly was set up, has been functioning ever since, and the Soviet Union has merely boycotted it, but has not prevented it from operating. Well, here in a brief outline is the record to date of the United Nations in action. It is necessarily incomplete, but it hits, I think, the high spot. I think it is an impressive record. It is undoubtedly a mixed one. It is a story of success and failure, of achievement and frustration, and perhaps above all, of hope and discouragement. Many difficulties of many different kinds have attended the work of the United Nations during its 4 years of operation. Some of them have been peculiar to the organization itself. A new piece of international machinery through which the nations have been struggling with the problems of peace, stability, and progress in the aftermath of the most widespread and destructive war in history. Most of these difficulties, and I think by all odds the most important ones, have resulted from the fact that the work of the United Nations, which is a voluntary association of sovereign states, in no sense a super state, has been and must necessarily be a reflection of what takes place in the world in general outside the organization. I have already alluded or indicated the fact that some of, by far the most serious difficulties that have confronted the United Nations have resulted from the attitude and behavior of the Soviet Union. Whatever reasons had prompted the Soviet leaders to take a very active part in the negotiations that led up to the establishment of the United Nations, ever since the organization and the many agencies that cluster around it as parts of the United Nations system have begun to operate, the Soviet Union has pursued a policy of almost continuous non-cooperation and obstruction. Refused to accept membership in the specialized agencies, in spite of the fact that it had participated in their creation. There's only one exception, the World Health Organization, and since the Soviet Union accepted membership in that, it has resigned and made its core perfect. As already noted, it has refused to take part in the little assembly. Now it has started a general boycott of the United Nations because it is dissatisfied with the representation of China. It has obstructed the work of, made more difficult the work of many organs and agencies of the United Nations, and it has used and abused the veto privilege in the Security Council. In fact, the veto question has become symbolic of all the difficulties experienced by the United Nations, in spite of the fact that, as I have described, the veto has affected only some of the many and varied activities of the United Nations. However, in view of the prominence of the veto question is assumed in discussions regarding the United Nations, it is well perhaps to pause for a few minutes and take a look at what this veto problem is all about. I know if I don't do it now, you'll ask me about it when my talk is over. So I'm going to do it right now. When the original plans for a post-war international organization were being developed, there were two great issues that had to be resolved. One of these pertained to the kind and extent of authority to be given to the United Nations. The other related to the voting procedures by which that authority would be exercised. Now, in the field of peace and security, first of all, a choice had to be made between giving the new organization the authority to settle international disputes and to enforce its decisions, or empowering it only to promote and facilitate the settlement of international differences, controversies and disputes by the nations themselves. Rightly or wrongly, those who determined this country's position at that time and the representatives of this country and of the other countries participating in the international negotiations came to the conclusion that it was not possible to go beyond the second alternative. Without passing on the theoretical possibility that someday an international organization might be created which would have the authority and the means to settle all international controversies, the negotiators formulated the Charter of the United Nations in terms of vesting in the organization authority only to promote and foster peaceful adjustment and pacific settlement of international disputes, rather than of providing for enforceable settlement of such disputes. There was, however, another phase of the situation. It pertained to the question whether or not the organization would be empowered to use armed force and other means of coercion as instruments for keeping the peace, in the sense of making as certain as possible that force would not be used by the nations individually as means of international action. Our policymakers and those of the other countries were in agreement that to this extent the new international organization should be endowed with the authority and the means of keeping the peace. This was done on the theory that if resort to violence could be eliminated, there would be a reasonable expectation that the processes of Pacific adjustment and settlement could be made operative. In connection with both phases of this situation, it was necessary to decide whether the new organization would function as had the League of Nations on the basis of a complete unanimity of all its members on all decisions, with the exception of a few enumerated ones, or of a complete application to all its decisions of some sort of a majority vote, or on the basis of a combination of the two procedures. This point was of particular concern to the major nations, since it was clear that a system of joint international action would impose upon them special responsibilities in view of the fact that they would have to provide the bulk of the forces and resources that would be necessary for joint action. This country and the other major nations were willing to see the organization operate on the basis of a majority rule in every respect except in the use of force and in the activities closely connected with the use of force. So far as those of us who were working on this problem in Washington were concerned, it appeared clear to us at that time that the American people would not consent to a situation in which American armed forces would be used for joint international action without this country's consent. I might add that most of those of us who were concerned in the government with the formulation of basic policies in this regard were also convinced that given the current and prospective circumstances of international relations, this country should not consent to any such arrangement. It was clear that the only way in which the United States could safeguard itself in this regard was to have a system under which no decision involving the actual or potential use of armed force could be made without its consent. It was equally clear that the only way in which this could be carried out in practice was for the same principle to apply in the cases of the other major nations. In other words, the system of voting should be such that any decisions of the kind that I have just described would require the unanimous consent of the major nations. This is the so-called veto. There were no illusions as to the limitations that such an arrangement would impose upon the effectiveness of the proposed organization, nor as to the possibility that the great privilege which the major nations thus claimed for themselves might be abused. It was obvious that under such a system, any one of the major nations would be in a position not only to stop action against itself, but to stop any collective action. The underlying theory, however, was that if one of the major nations were to prove to be recalcitrant, were to refuse to abide by the rules of international behavior that were being inscribed in the Charter, a situation would be created in which the recalcitrant nation might have to be coerced. And it was apparent that no major nation could be coerced except by the combined forces of the other major nations. This would be the equivalent of a world war, and a decision to embark upon such a war would necessarily have to be made by each of the other major nations and not by any international organization. It might be pertinent to ask this question. What reason do those of us who worked on the creation of the United Nations have to believe that the organization they were constructing would succeed? The answer to that question, I think, is relatively simple. All of the signatories of the Charter were pledging themselves to follow a set of rules of international behavior which, if faithfully observed, would offer the best chance that we could see that international peace and security would be preserved.